Call Your Advocate podcast. Today's episode is about healing from childhood sexual abuse. I'm your host, Carolina Strain, and today's special guest is Leah Green. She's a rural technical assistant specialist at the Resource Sharing Project. For today's podcast, I just wanted to give everyone a trigger warning that we're going to be talking about some disturbing things that might trigger you, like sexual violence, domestic violence, and power-based violence, and how it affects a victim. I hope you take care of yourself and possibly stay tuned for this episode. You're listening to the Call Your Advocate podcast. I'm your host, Carolina Strain, and today's topic is healing from sexual abuse. My special guest today is Leah Green. Hi, Leah.
Hey.
How are you doing?
Really excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you on. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Leah Green. And first, I'm a survivor. And I started in this movement in college as a volunteer working with domestic violence and sexual assault survivors, both on my campus and also in the neighboring community. And I worked then, after I left school, as an advocate and a prevention educator in a few different programs around the state of Iowa doing advocacy. And now I work for the Resource Sharing Project, which is a national organization that provides resources, training, and support to programs and state and territorial coalitions that serve survivors of sexual violence.
I'm so happy I get to have you on my podcast because you have so much valuable information for people. And like you said, you're a survivor. So who better to hear it from than you? Can you tell me a little bit about why talking about this is something we should be bringing awareness to?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because as a culture and to some degree as a movement, we're really open and interested and supportive in helping children that were sexually abused. We have CACs, child advocacy centers. We talk about that more and more in the public. There's a lot of support, at least emotionally. There's a lot of openness and support to help children. Obviously, there could always be more resources and money thrown around. But there's this idea that we understand that children that are sexually abused deserve resources and help. But there's this strange thing that happens where we just sort of forget that those children, many, many of whom aren't able to come forward and sort of break their silence in childhood, grow up to be adults that are still grappling with a lot of the same pieces of the trauma of childhood, but now into adulthood. And so I think it's just really important that we recognize that like trauma doesn't go away when we turn 18 or when we reach some sort of milestone in our life, like marriage or having kids or being an older adult, retiring. Like none of those markers of time actually get rid of trauma. And so many adult survivors of child sexual abuse, I think, are really looking for resources, resources. And I think that as a movement, as an anti-sexual violence movement, we put a lot of emphasis and resources in sort of how the criminal legal system can fix the problem of sexual abuse. A lot of advocacy centers, I think, around the country see themselves as a connection from survivors to the criminal legal system and help people go through the criminal legal system and hold their perpetrators accountable. And that's great, but I think that it forgets that really the purpose of advocacy is to help survivors of sexual violence heal. And I think that adult survivors of child sexual abuse is such a perfect example for our movement to see the limitations of the criminal legal system. There are so many survivors who, once they are in a place of like safety and trust enough to come forward and disclose, no longer have the criminal legal system as an option anymore. And there still needs to be healing. And so our programs can really change the way that we offer services to survivors thinking first and foremost about adult survivors of child sexual abuse. When we center adult survivors of child sexual abuse, it means that our programs have to think way more creatively and expansively about what healing looks like, what support looks like. And for some people, including adult survivors of child sexual abuse, that does mean going through the criminal legal system, in which, you know, great, that's awesome. Clearly, we are well practiced at that as a movement. But when we think about all the other ways that survivors need to heal, I think that we can create stronger services for survivors, all survivors of sexual violence.
I think listening to you, what stands out to me is like, we are doing everything we can as advocates to be there for them and support them through the legal process. But as human beings, we need to acknowledge that this type of trauma invokes all types of psychological, mental, and emotional problems. Even if it's years later and they're an adult, if they've never processed it, that trauma, if they've never spoken about it, and most don't disclose till way later, you know, they need help with that. And as advocates, we're supposed to help them with what they want to be helped with. So if they want to process the legal system, yes, of course, we'll be there for you. But if they want emotional support or counseling, it's important for advocacy centers to offer that too, that important piece of trauma-informed responses for emotional and psychological well-being of a person that's been abused as a child and is now an adult.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of limitations to the criminal legal system. And unfortunately, you know, because of funding, because of societal ideas of what healing looks like, that's sort of the only option I think a lot of survivors think is open to them. And so it can be so radically cool and empowering to get to help people realize that there's actually like a million, truly a million other options to go forward. We'll talk about a lot of those today, but I literally will not be able to say them all because there really is sort of an infinite possibility of answers for what each survivor needs to heal. And like I said, I think it's important to think of adult survivors as a good representative of like what the limitations of the criminal legal system are. And I've worked with survivors that spoke up when they were children and did get resources and support and did go through the criminal legal system. And still, when you come to the end of that, even if you're able to hold your perpetrator accountable, even if they spend time in jail or in prison, that doesn't mean you're healed. You still have to move on with the rest of your life and figure out, you know, relationships, trust, intimacy, sex, boundaries, your mental health. There's so many other aspects. And so when our advocacy ends at the end of the criminal legal system, we're doing a disservice to survivors. I also want to share this quote that I think really resonates with me with what we're talking about right now. It's from the book Love with Accountability, Digging Up the Roots of Child Sexual Abuse, edited by Aisha Shadid Simmons. And it is in the chapter written by Cecilia Falls. She says, "Punishing the perpetrator becomes the immediate goal to address the issue. While this is important, it does little to address the long-term impacts of the abuse on the survivor. Another one of those things that is odd to me, given how we admit that there are long-term effects, but so little done to address them." So I think that just really encapsulates everything we've been saying about the fact that holding the perpetrator accountable can be powerful, it can be healing, it can be helpful, it's helpful to the community, but it's not going to fix all the trauma that the survivor experienced. There's still so much there that then we have to process.
And what I want listeners to understand is that 1 in 9 girls and 1 in 53 boys are under the age of 18 when they experience sexual abuse or assault at the hands of an adult. Perpetrators of childhood sexual abuse are often related to their victim. Amongst cases of child sexual abuse reported to law enforcement, 7% are from strangers, 59% are from acquaintances, and 34% are from family members. So why do most victims of childhood sexual abuse wait to disclose? Because that's the big question that a lot of people that don't work in advocacy don't understand that. Like, why would you wait 12 or 10 years to finally say something? Can you explain that?
Absolutely. I think that there's this really great quote in the book, I Never Told Anyone, Writings by Women Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse. It's edited by Ellen Bass and Louise Thornton, that I think for me sort of encapsulates a lot of what we're talking about here. They say, children are dependent upon adults, first for their survival, then for affection, attention, and an understanding of what the world in which they live is all about. Children trust the adults in their lives, even when the adults are untrustworthy because they have no choice. When that trust is betrayed, they learn the world is not dependable. By actions as well as by words, adults teach children what to fear, what to trust, what is good, bad, shameful, safe, possible. Children either accept our definitions or, if their experience is radically different, as it is for children who are molested, they are thrown into conflict, confusion, insecurity, and anguish. And I think that that is such a good example, such a good summary of what we're talking about when we talk about child sexual abuse. That during that time that it happens, you have little understanding of the world, of what boundaries are, of what love is, of what trust looks like, of what safety feels like. And so if that's your experience, you're going to have a lot of issues growing into adulthood understanding those concepts because they were mistaught to you from childhood, whether it was by a family member, someone you know really well, it could have been a stranger, that which is less likely but happens. But still, there's those feelings. A lot of survivors feel like when they were children, like, well, why weren't my family members able to protect me, or why was the behavior that I exhibited as a result of the trauma punished from my family members? There's a lot wrapped up in like family, because when you were sexually abused as a child, you're inherently under the care of other people. And so a lot of that gets wrapped up in it, whether they were the ones that hurt you or not. And so, you know, why this question of why survivors wait to disclose, I think that there are a lot of different reasons. So for some, it is that they truly did forget. The book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma by Bessel van der Kolk. The author calls it the unbearable heaviness of remembering, which I think is the most beautiful way to describe deep anguish at then remembering the abuse that happens in adulthood. You know, when you're growing up and your brain is still forming, your body is incredible at protecting you. And so when that abuse happens young, it is so much easier to shove it in a box in the back of your brain and try so hard to forget that it happened. And a lot of survivors remember in adulthood, sometimes when the feeling of some sense of safety can return to their lives because they have moved away from the perpetrator, because the person that hurt them died, or just more time and space in their life allows them the opportunity to process and remember. And those memories resurface and flood them. Some survivors remember because they, you know, are giving up the coping mechanisms that got them through the abuse, whether that's disordered eating or drugs and alcohol, or, you know, a number of coping mechanisms that, you know, helped them get to the age in which they remembered. But when you give those up, when you push those aside, when you decide you want something else for your life, when you try to be the best version of yourself, and in doing so, believe you're going to give up these coping mechanisms, a lot of times memories kind of bubble to the surface when you're not, when you're not numbing yourself anymore. A lot of survivors also of particularly horrible child sexual abuse develop dissociative identity disorder, DID. And so there is a version of their self that takes over, that experiences the abuse, that is their self who deals with that trauma. And so sometimes survivors are so fragmented and dissociated that they really just don't know what's going on. And of course, you know, there are still survivors that never forgot, that always remember, and still chose not to disclose because it makes it real to say it out loud, to talk to another person about it. It makes it something you suddenly have to deal with, right? Like, to say it out loud says, and now I'm going to wrestle with this. Now I'm going to do something with this. And when you don't know where to go next, that can feel so scary. Other survivors remember always, but thought of the experiences as consensual or part of a relationship. And as they get older, recontextualize the abuse. When they get to, you know, when they have children that are suddenly the age they were when they experienced the abuse, and they can see how young and naive and vulnerable they were, I think that recontextualizes. You know, when you're a child, I think sometimes you think you do have so much more power in the world than you really do. And so then when you can see children that same age, truly, you know, once again, there are so many reasons not to disclose. I could sit here and list them all afternoon, but I think a lot of it comes down also to silence. It becomes ingrained in you. Whenever you do remember, or if you never forgot, it is a horrible, hard, and, you know, awful, all the adjectives experience. And keeping it silent sometimes feels safer. There's this other quote that I wanted to read that resonated with me when we talk about this. The book is called Love with Accountability, Digging Up the Roots of Child Sexual Abuse, edited by Aisha Shadid Simmons. And it's a book of like 42, I think, essays of adult survivors of child sexual abuse that are all part of the African diaspora. And this particular quote is from a woman named Lynn Roberts. She says, "My own silence began when I was around 6 years young. And while I've broken my silence several times since, I've retreated back into various forms of silence over the course of my 50 years in this world as I know it." And later she says, "My voice became one of the few things I could control in my childhood. No one could make me speak if I did not want to." And I feel like that breaks this notion, I think, that we also have, that if you name it, if you disclose to someone, if you say it out loud, that suddenly you have to tell everyone or talk about it or deal with it. I think a lot of survivors go through sort of fits and starts of telling someone and pulling that box out I don't know why this is always the analogy that I go to, pulling that box out from the back of your brain and sort of opening it up and peering inside and saying, am I willing to pull all these things out and look at them? And sometimes the answer is no, and let's close the box and shove it back inside. And sometimes the answer is, well, I'll pull out this one piece and see if this fits or how I feel about this. And no, I'm going to close the box, but maybe I won't shove it all the way to the back this time. Maybe it'll just sort of live here. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said around the powerfulness of silence and secrecy and keeping it to yourself as a form of comfort almost.
I really appreciate everything you just said. I think that even though we obviously can't go over every single reason why people don't disclose earlier for childhood sexual abuse, but what I will say is that everything you've said thus far, I think any listener, especially one that's experienced childhood sexual abuse, will agree with. There are so many varieties of reasons why you don't say it till you can or till you want to. And I think the want to is very important. I know as an advocate that works specifically with children, you know, one of the things that I had to really learn and understand and kind of dive into was when children disclose, there is this initial barrier as a child with your support system. It's normal for a family member, for a mother, for a father to want to ask, are you sure? How do you know? Like, it's normal to have that response. But see, the problem with that is the child already has so much shame around what has happened. And if there was grooming involved, which usually there is, a child also might feel responsible for what has happened. And so, are you sure? Is a question that puts them in a defense and wants to make them hide in shame and say, you know what? I lied. It wasn't true. Forget it. Especially if it's a family member, a husband, a neighbor, a daycare sitter, like people that the family might know intimately, you know, for the child, it's scary to come out. It's a scary thing to say, but then to have that initial response for your support system, your safety person to say, are you sure? It makes you want to say, you know what? You can't even handle my truth. I'm just going to stay quiet. And they hold on to that silence because that was their one tidbit, you know? So I think that's important because we don't want to blame the parents that question. You know, it's a normal human response to want to question. But what I would say is if a child ever discloses sexual abuse, even if you have doubts, the best way to support them is to be a good listener, to really just soak in as much information as possible, to be there for them and tell them no matter what, it was never your fault. You are a child. I am here for you and to keep you safe. So for people that wonder why children don't disclose sooner, I would say shame and blame has a lot to do with the internal logic of why to stay quiet for so long.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for, you know, for parents listening also, I think children, even when there is so much shame and fear as to stay silent, I think children try to say in their own way. They wet the bed, they struggle at school, they stop being able to sleep. There's some signs to think about, because even if we stay silent, I think our body still tries to say, tries to disclose, tries to share.
I always tell parents, like, behaviors are communication. If they're changed in personality, if they can't hang around a certain person in the family, they don't tell you why, but they just can't be around that person. If they are knowing about stuff that you've never talked about in front of them, whether it's pornography or certain positions or certain language or certain body parts, and it's above their age and you don't even know where they could have got it from. These are red flags. These are warning signs. It's not for sure. I'm not going to say if your child is doing all of these or one of these that they've been sexually abused, but people ask me all the time, what can I look out for? And these are a few of the things. Your child will communicate something to you through their behaviors. For people that haven't processed their trauma, those behaviors go with you throughout your life in a different form. So maybe they won't understand boundaries because their boundaries were broken. Maybe they won't understand for them, they'll correlate love with pain. So any relationship going forward is going to need that pain aspect for them to think that they're being loved, because that initial response when they were a child was supposed to be love and respect and protection, and now it's love and pain. So just understand that disclosure in general is really hard, but it's even harder when you feel like you're not even supported by the most intimate people in your life. I wanted to ask you, is it true that most adult victims of childhood sexual abuse know their abuser, or is that more or less a myth? And I know I did a stat, but you're my expert today. Tell me what you think.
Sure. So I think the current official stat is something like 80% of child sexual abuse survivors know in some way the person that harmed them. So sometimes it's family, sometimes it's friends of the family, faith leaders, daycare providers, really anyone that the child knows. And I think that that leads to so many complications then in adulthood and with the healing process, because there's often a lot to unpack there when it's someone that you know, someone that you or your family trusted or has an ongoing relationship with. And so whether the survivor discloses in childhood, and the family responds, or the people taking care of the child respond accordingly and remove that person that harmed the child from their life, there's a lot of guilt around that. Survivors experiencing their parents divorcing because their father was the one that harmed them, or knowing that their grandparents aren't around, allowed to come around anymore because their grandfather was the one who harmed them, and their siblings are upset that they can't see their grandparents anymore. You know, just the complicated feelings that come even when we take the child away from harm. But unfortunately, the reality is that most survivors won't speak up in childhood, won't be heard, and won't have that person taken away from them. And so even in adulthood, the complicated emotions that come when their family knows that person to be a trustworthy person, a upstanding citizen, someone helpful to their family, someone they have fond memories of, whatever that might be, how hard it can be to then want to break your silence and also break this notion that the person that your family loved or trusted or your family member wasn't worthy of that trust and love or adoration. And so, and just as you were saying earlier, that connection to the abuse and concepts of trust and love and safety really can complicate then in adulthood how you find safety, how you find trust, how you navigate boundaries in adulthood, how you form new relationships, because you once trusted and loved someone close to you that should have been safe and they weren't. So that teaches you a lot of deep things that you can, that you really bring in to adulthood.
I just want to say that for anyone listening, you know, if you have been a victim of childhood sexual abuse, and there is obviously complexities when it comes to the dynamics afterwards for the family and for you, and disclosing and figuring out how you can go to a Christmas dinner if that abuser is going to be there, know that you're not the only one. And again, it's not your fault. At that point, you have to do what's best for you as a person. If you don't feel comfortable disclosing yet, that's okay. That is perfectly okay. That's another part that I really think people don't understand. Like, why wouldn't you disclose? Maybe it's not safe. Maybe this is the worst thing that's ever happened to you, and you've built such a strong life outside of that, and you disclosing, you're scared that that's going to tarnish everything that you've built. Maybe you just want to forget, even if it's not really possible. And maybe you don't want people to look at you a certain way. So I just want people that have experienced that to know that it is difficult. It is hard to manage and navigate those waters of, do I disclose? What does that look like? If I do disclose, my family hates me afterwards, or how do I still go to these Christmas dinners and have that person there? How can I make myself not present when they're there? It is difficult. It's not your fault. And you're doing the very best you can. If you decide to disclose, I hope you have family members that support you. If not, know that there are resources like us, like the Avalon stuff, so many that will be there to support you. But we don't want you to feel at any point like you have to bury this and be alone, because you're not.
Yeah, I so agree. And I think there's also this complexity that we as a society really struggle to know, which is that it's a really hard truth, but people that harm children, people that sexually abuse children, they are people in the world. They are our friends, they're our neighbors, they're our family members. And that often also means that survivors have some positive associations or memories of the person that harmed them, and how deeply complicated that can be when you can remember happy memories of your uncle and spending time with him and the joy he brought your family and the little toys he brought you when you were a kid, or, you know, I'm just randomly naming things, but then also the abuse it's also, which is, you know, once again, I think leads us right back to the limitations of the criminal legal system, because I think a lot of survivors don't want to have the people that they also love and care about that harmed them then spend time in jail or prison, or be so publicly punished when they have complex relationships with those loved ones.
So I think the part that really stood out for me was the part that you said they're everyday people. And I think that's important for two reasons. One, because it is easier for us as a society to label people a certain way to disassociate from what we're not and who we don't hang around with. Like, I'd never be around someone like that. That's a monster, right? So it makes it feel safer for us psychologically. Like, that could have never happened to me, one. And two, I think the problem with that is then who are we looking for? Who are these monsters out there, right? It would be so much better if we were realistic about it and really looked at the data and saw there are women abusers. There are fathers with kids. There are priests. There are so many different types. There is not one type. It's every type of person. But the truth is, you probably ran into him at Publix or her at Publix. Like, it's just part of our society. And what they did was monstrosities. Anytime someone takes away a child's innocence and power and control and choice, that's bad. They're the average person. And we need to be aware. Awareness is good. That's what I think you're trying to say, right?
Yes, I couldn't have said it better myself. The only change I would make was I wouldn't have said Publix because I don't live in the South.
Sorry, Miami girl, I have to say Publix. Even as I live in Tennessee, I'm very proud of a Publix. I also want to make this important note that the younger the victim is, the more likely it is that the abuser is a family member. Of those molesting a child under six, 50% were family members. Family members are also accounted for 23% of those abusing children ages 12 to 17.
So this reminds me of this quote in the book, Trauma and Recovery, The Aftermath of Violence from Domestic Abuse to Political Terror, written by Judith Herman. She says, "Women quickly learn that rape is a crime only in theory. In practice, the standard for what constitutes rape is set not at the level of women's experience of violation, but just above the level of coercion acceptable to men." And I'm just going to acknowledge that this was written in the second wave of feminism and is very gender-based. People of all genders perpetrate violence and people of all genders experience violence. So we're going to know that listening to this quote. But I think it sort of applies also to how perpetrators can see themselves as good people also, because when we have that idea that all perpetrators, all people that hurt other people are monsters, that when that's the idea that they're a monster, either there are monsters and there are not monsters, every person on earth is going to put themselves in the category of not a monster, no matter what they've done. And so I think it's this, just above the level of coercion acceptable to, and let's just say people, that if you think that what you're doing, you're showing a child things too soon, pornography, if you are giving them little toys, all the sort of grooming things we're talking about, that I think is such a good example of coercion acceptable to people, that person feels like this is okay, this isn't bad, but they're going down a slippery slope. And I think this is the perfect time for us to just quickly name that when we're talking about child sexual abuse, I probably should have set this up at the top, that when we're talking about child sexual abuse, we're talking about experiences that traumatized you, that made you uncomfortable, that you're still coping with today, whether the person touched you or not.
Yes.
Whether, you know, what, no matter what level or on the spectrum of sexual violence you want to call it, that if it made you deeply uncomfortable, that I am happy to call what you experienced child sexual abuse, and you can call it whatever you want, but you deserve the right to process that and heal from that. There isn't a level, there's not a threshold you have to pass for us to call it child sexual abuse. If someone was in the middle of grooming you and stopped and, you know, no touching actually happened, you can still, as an adult, look back at that experience and feel disturbed by that, to recognize it for what it was, to make it feel icky in the pit of your stomach, right? Like, so I think so much of also what that quote brings is that violence is at the level that we decide that it is. It's not at the level of what perpetrators get to decide what violence is. We ourselves get to decide what we need to heal from.
Absolutely. When I think about that, I think about what you said about looking back on your history and maybe realizing as an adult that did happen to me, even if it's just because now you have a child and so you have these feelings coming at you. Uncomfortable is a really good word to describe when I even talk to children about, hey, if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, speak to your safe person. So as an adult looking back, did you ever feel uncomfortable? Did an adult ever make you feel as if they were being too friendly or too inappropriate or too handsy? Maybe they never touched your private parts or did anything sexual, but they made you feel like if you belonged to them. And so being very aware of that is important. And knowing, again, not your fault. You were a child. That person has all the authority in that situation. They're the adult. So how does the trauma impact an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse?
I will fail to say all the ways that trauma impacts adult survivors of child sexual abuse, because once again, it is an endless stream of ways. And so I just want to start by saying that it impacts every facet of your life, every part of your life. And I think it's helpful to go back to what we were talking about and center that as we move forward. This idea that when you were a child and the violence happened, that you didn't know what safety was like, what love was like, what boundaries were, this concept we keep bringing up. Because when you view it from that lens, when you imagine yourself as a child and the level of powerlessness and lack of control that you had about where you were, what happened with your body, where you went, I think that's where we start from to think about the ways that moves then into adulthood. I think for a lot of survivors, you learn that your body is not your own, that you do not have bodily autonomy, that other people own your body, other people get to touch you, other people get to do what they want with your body. And that leads to a lot of numbing and dissociation, because that's deeply uncomfortable and hard to deal with. Whether the abuse happened once or over and over for years, it doesn't matter, that you learned a lesson about what your body was for that is hard to forget.
This correlation that you've learned through physical stuff with your body, of what your body is for, and your mind remembers it and stores it and says,
exactly,
what it's for.
Exactly. So I think that there's some, you know, it means we have to address both as we move forward, because it wasn't just your mind that experienced that. And we do need to address that, but also the ways that you were impacted was your literal body was impacted. And so there's a deep connection with physical health problems and adult survivors of child sexual abuse. There's a connection to infertility, gynecological issues, gastrointestinal issues, autoimmune disorders, migraines. I mean, the list goes on and on of the ways that your body experienced the violence and has now impacted your physical health. And I think it's really important to know, because I think a lot of people that, you know, are adult survivors of child sexual abuse just sort of have this running commentary in their brain that, like, they're broken, there's something wrong with them, they did something wrong that caused these problems, or just there isn't a known, an understanding and a connection between the abuse and the health problems. It's just sort of, a lot of people conceptualize it as, there's just something wrong with my body that I didn't cause. So I have a close friend who went through a lot of infertility issues and is an adult survivor of child sexual abuse. And when I was able to, like, share that connection with her, it was, like, profound. It was, there's not just something wrong with me that I can't have a child easily. I didn't do anything to cause this. What happened to my body is the cause. And I think that there's some amount of healing in just being able to make those connections and name it and, like, feel power in that.
I think it's important because a lot of people don't know about the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, which really goes in depth to what you're talking about, this correlation between physical ailments and diseases and trauma, especially childhood sexual trauma, which is one of the ACEs that you could have. And for anyone who has not heard of that study, please look it up. It's overwhelming. That's what I will say. It's good to really get this out there. You're not broken. It's something that we tell ourselves when you've been a victim. I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. Because it has to be me. It can't be the other person. The other person's fine and living their life, or, you know, nothing's happened to them. And I'm the one here dealing with this. So just remind yourself as much as possible. It wasn't your fault. You're not broken. This isn't you. This was what happened to you.
So there's the health piece, the medical sort of side of things. I think there's also a lot of impact then from the trauma in adulthood into, as we've been saying, building relationships, building trust, navigating boundaries, sex and sexuality. Some survivors struggle with sexual boundaries because they deeply learned the lesson that their body was not their own and meant to be used by other people. And hypersexuality, for lack of a better word, is sort of how they cope and how they move about the world. Other people are afraid for people to touch their body and are celibate and abstain from relationships and building romantic relationships or friendships, because how do you know how to trust someone again, or who's a trustworthy person? I think a lot of survivors don't know what, like, internal safety feels like, because for folks that didn't experience violence at a young age, you learned what safety feels like. You learned that when you cry, your parents are going to pick you up and they're going to comfort you. You learned that your body is your own and you get to make decisions. You learned what safety feels like, not just in your surroundings, but, like, in your own body. And as a survivor of child sexual abuse, a lot of survivors don't learn what that feeling of safety feels like in their body. And so it's really hard then in adulthood to figure out what, you know, relationship, what workspace, what just, like, homeostasis, what is me sitting in a chair, feeling my body, how do I know if I feel safe or if I feel calm or if I feel chaotic? There's a lot of numbing and dissociation, as we've talked about, that happens. And so it can be really hard for adult survivors to even begin to be able to be still with their body and feel safe. That doing things like meditation and mindfulness is terrifying, because it means you're going to sort of sit with your body and accept your body for what it is. That is really hard to do.
I think it's important that people know this, because everybody does respond to trauma differently, especially childhood sexual abuse. But I can say that, you know, some people going into that sexual aspect might even be having sex because they feel they have to, and they have experienced pleasure once in all of their sexual experience, but they feel like they have to, because this is just a part of society and this is what I have to do.
I think it's really hard for a lot of survivors to even figure out that the answer to do I want to have sex right now is no.
Yeah.
Because to know that, you have to be able to sit with your body and be comfortable to think like, is this really what I want in my mind? And is this really what I want for my body right now? Would this feel good to me? And I think so many survivors have like bypassed that decision-making process in their brain and just go straight to the sex or the coping mechanism, whatever it is, because it's that it feels terrifying. And when you learn dissociation at such a young age, it is like it's like second nature.
Yeah.
You don't even notice it happening. It's not like the idea of dissociation is presented to you and you opt in and say, yeah, I'd like to be dissociating right now. You just do it. It just happens. And so it's really hard for a lot of survivors without some help or conversation or a partner to work through or an advocate to talk to this about, to even be able to pinpoint the moment that the dissociation is happening and to then be able to make the choices you actually want to be making.
So when we talk about impact, we're talking about also obviously the psychological impact to childhood sexual abuse. It goes without saying, but this really does affect every portion of your life, from your relationships to your sexuality to the way you think of yourself as a human being. All of it is affected.
Yeah, it really impacts your mental health a lot. And I think there's this other thing that we don't talk about as much, that in all the reading and conversations I've had the opportunity to have has really been present for me lately, which is that I think a lot of survivors need to heal from the trauma. But then a lot of survivors still have a lot of feelings and grief that they need to heal the choices that they made to get through the trauma.
Yes.
That because of the trauma, they use drugs and alcohol. Because of the trauma, they had a lot of sex that they weren't happy and didn't want to be having. Because of the trauma, they cut or attempted suicide. Because of the trauma, you know, so many things. And then feeling like the coping mechanism that you used to get through your life to make it one day further is something that caused you harm emotionally or physically. And I think there's a lot of grief there in feeling as though that was a choice that they made and are so like upset with themselves that they made those choices.
It goes back to blame and shame.
Like, exactly.
How do you treat yourself mentally when you think of yourself and you think of everything you've done to survive? A lot of the times it's a negative perspective. I shouldn't have been smoking cigarettes every day. I shouldn't have been drinking. But you did those things just to help yourself make it through the day. So have some self-compassion, because not a lot of people could go through what you went through, and you did it to survive. And I think that that's important, right?
And unfortunately, we do not get to pick our coping mechanisms.
Nope.
Because if I could pick my coping mechanism, let me tell you, I'd pick like being a workaholic. I would pick a lot of things that'd be more beneficial to me. But we don't get to pick that. We don't get to choose. We just make it through each day. And so I think when survivors are navigating healing for the first time, we need to think about sort of those two pieces together and heal them both. I think the last piece when it comes to sort of the impact of the trauma on adult survivors is the trauma and the ways that it is deeply entwined with racism and oppression and white supremacy. And that the trauma that you experienced and who you are as a person because of racism or oppression might have meant that you had less resources available to you. And there is a lot to be unpacked there about the ways that they are intertwined. And I just think that there's this deep connection between the trauma and racism that is really complicated. And I think part of healing is unraveling all of that and figuring out where you fit in it.
I think that depending what your culture is, what your background is, how you were raised, what your community is, you're obviously going to feel either more oppression or less, depending on what's around you and what resources are there for you or the lack of them. And when you think about disclosure, think that I literally have nowhere in my community that I can turn to for support for this. Obviously, you're going to stay quiet longer. I always tell people your support system is there for your emotional state, but it's also there for when you need help with something outside of your emotional state. You need like physical help to do something. So the less of a support system you have, the more likely you're either going to feel burnt out or you're going to feel burdened and you're going to shut down and you're going to repress. There's so many negative things that happen. There's a disproportionate amount of resources in certain communities, and that's evident to anybody that looks into the data. Thinking about that and thinking about what resources are available for adults that are survivors of childhood sexual abuse. Do they have to make a report just to get resources? Let's go ahead and end some myths now and just talk about it.
Absolutely. No, you absolutely do not need to make a report to law enforcement to receive services or at all. I think some survivors, you know, find comfort in that, especially if they feel like the person that harmed them could still be harming other children. If you want to make a report just because that's your sense of feeling as though you're holding someone accountable, do it. Do anything that makes you feel better, anything that feels healing to you, do it. But you absolutely don't need to do it. And if I'm being just realistic, making a report to law enforcement likely will not result when you're an adult in an investigation or moving farther into the criminal legal system. Most of the survivors that I've worked with that are adults, when they make a report to law enforcement, the police officer is pretty frank in letting them know that it's really just sort of a cursory report to take the report, and that likely nothing else will happen with that information. As far as what resources are available then for adult survivors of child sexual abuse outside the criminal legal system or outside reporting to law enforcement, I sort of think of two separate ones. So I think of advocacy programs, and I think of just the community at large. And so I obviously am deeply tied to advocacy programs, and I think a lot about what advocacy programs can do for adult survivors, and we'll definitely, you know, keep talking about that. But I also think that there is this aspect of the community, because the number one thing that we know that is how folks who've experienced trauma heal is finding community, is breaking your silence, being able to talk to other people, and building that community. And advocacy programs can be part of building that community. But if that doesn't feel good, if there isn't one that feels supportive in your community, if it just isn't what you're into, you don't have to access advocacy programs to build that community. But try to find other people that either experienced what you experienced or just that are supportive and love you and care to start talking about some of these things. Try to find support groups, reach out for in online community spaces, read books. There's a lot of books, you know, that I've mentioned today on the podcast, but also, you know, more that I can ask Carolina to put in the show notes, mm-hmm. if that's what's helpful. Because I think so much of what feels, especially sort of at the beginning of the healing process, that feels really powerful is just reading other survivors sharing their own experiences. And it helps you feel like, I am not a freak. I am not a weirdo. I'm not the only person this has ever happened to. I'm not alone. There are other people. You know, this person's experience was similar to mine. This person's experience was not at all similar to mine, but wow, I felt the same way. We had all the same feelings and emotions and ways we coped with it, even though what we experienced is different. So whatever that community can look like to you, even if it's just one other human being that you know you can talk to about this, I encourage you to access that.
What does the healing process consist of for victims? And obviously, like we've been saying many times throughout this podcast, it can look differently. But what do you want victims to know about the healing process?
I think the first thing that comes to mind when I think about the healing process is that it's maybe an exhausting statement to say, but it's never really over. There isn't going to be a time in your life where you say, for most survivors, I'm over it, I'm healed, I've fixed it all, this is never going to come back up, and I'm done. Unfortunately, I don't think it works that way. But I think when you start to tackle it, when you start to, you know, to continue this analogy, pull the box out of the back of your brain and open it up and start to look at all of it, put it in the sunlight, figure out how it all connects to each other, you will get more and more comfortable with the abuse and yourself and how you've coped, and every day will be easier than the last one. And you'll start to know yourself. You'll start to know how your body works. You'll start to know how you respond. You'll start to know what triggers, you know, deep emotions, what brings back those feelings of helplessness. And you'll start to learn what are the ways in which you can cope with those triggers or those experiences that feel healing and kind to yourself. And every time those feelings come back up, you will feel easier and better at trying to do it. You're practicing something, and when you practice it, you're getting better at it. And every time something traumatic happens, you go to the doctor and the doctor touches you before saying he's going to touch you, and you feel those overwhelming emotions and you're struggling and you don't know how to go back to work or focus on what you were doing after your appointment. As an example, you know, you'll have more and more and more resources to reach for that you know are soothing to you, that feel good, that are healing. So so healing, it takes time and you're always sort of working on it, but it won't always feel like work.
Yes.
And I think that the second thing that comes to mind is really this idea that we can't process everything cognitively, that going to a therapist and talking it all out can't fix all the trauma that we've experienced in childhood, that the trauma happened to your body. And so healing also has to happen for your body. And you get to pick what that looks like and you get to go at the pace that you want. But I think a lot of what is healing is to befriend your body, to be kind to your body and figure out what your body likes, what makes your body feel good, what makes your body feel safe. I know that when I first started sort of the healing process, I started going swimming, and I hadn't been swimming in years. And I joined a gym just so I could swim in the water, and which was very confusing to the gym. And they were like, you don't want to lose weight. And I'm like, no, I'm here to process my child sexual abuse. And
their faces were like, okay, and the pool door is over there.
Exactly. And I got in the lap lane and I dove under the water, and I had to stand back up because I was smiling so big and like uncontrollably laughing. My body was feeling so much joy that it had not felt in a long time. And I was connected to that joy. And so for the first probably 5 times I went swimming there, I couldn't like do proper laps because my mouth was smiling so big, I couldn't close my mouth to, you know, breathe in and out of my nose. It's just one little thing I think of about what feels healing. Figure out what feels good to your body. Is it running? Is it walking in nature? A lot of being in the being in nature, being in the forest, being surrounded by trees, being near water feels so good to me. I feel like at peace with myself when I'm in nature. I feel that sense, that like elusive sense of safety that was hard to find. And I find it when I'm hiking, when I'm in the forest. And so I can recognize that feeling of this is what safety feels like. This is what it feels good like. This is what it feels good to be in my body right now. That's what that feels like. And then when I come home from my hike and I'm in my everyday life and that feeling feels more elusive, at least I have a home base. I have a concept. I've taught my body, I know what it feels like to be safe. And now it's a little bit easier to figure out that feeling of safety in my body now that I have some concept of what it feels like for me.
I think that you gave people a visual illustration of how to find safety within yourself. And I think the key piece to what you were saying is be kind to your body. I would also add, be kind to your mind. I mean, anyone that's experienced any form of trauma, the things that you think about yourself can be so harsh. Be kind to yourself in general. Even if you were never shown kindness, experiment with what does kindness for myself look like? Because when you do find it, that is your baseline. And that's where you start to seek joy from. And that's where every time you're having a troubled moment, you can bounce back quicker because now you know where baseline is. This is all steps towards resilience. And I think it's great that you really talked us through what does it look like to find safety within yourself.
And I think what's the most powerful is when you put what I said and what you said together. You know, start a garden and feel in your body what it feels like to touch the dirt, to be on your hands and your knees, picking out weeds, feel the sunshine on your skin. Really try to feel your body. And at the same time, be thinking, I'm an amazing gardener. I'm kicking butt. I'm going to grow the crap out of these vegetables. They're going to be so delicious. And I'm going to nourish my body with my hard work. Like have that, that like cognitive positive talk in your head while also befriending your body, feeling good in your body. And I think that is huge. I think another piece of the sort of the healing process for me is always the education piece. Is learning more about the ways that child sexual abuse impacts people is in and of itself hugely healing when you can make that connection between the abuse and what you experience in your life. Because there's this grief, I think, that comes with being an adult survivor of child sexual abuse, because when the abuse happens when you're a child, you don't get to figure out who you were going to be before that abuse ever happened. You don't get to know how you'd respond to things, what your personality would be like, who you would have been was also impacted by the trauma, that you don't get to know what that's like, who you would have been. And so some of the education piece is making some of those connections and sorting out like, what is just the quirks of Leah Green and what is the connection to the abuse that I experienced? And, you know, I'm 31 years old. I almost didn't remember how old I was. I'm 31 years old. I've been at this for a while now. I'm, you know, some would call me an expert on child sexual abuse, and I'm still daily, you know, picking at things, figuring out, oh, wow, that feels connected. Just the other day, a colleague asked me why I don't drink coffee, because I've just never been a coffee drinker. And when someone asked me that question, I had to really think about what the real answer was. And I realized that for myself, it was this idea that when I was a child, I saw my parents drink coffee in the morning and they couldn't function without it, as so many of us can't function without caffeine, right? But I remember feeling how scary the concept that my body wouldn't feel normal or right without something else in it, that without caffeine in the morning, I was going to feel different. I was going to feel groggy. I was going to feel tired. That was a really scary feeling. And now as an adult, and I can look back and say, where'd that fear and that hesitancy come from? And I think it's, you know, it's deeply tied to the abuse. Now, is that the most traumatizing part of my abuse? No, but just making that connection that, like, still, even today, there's all these little bits of my life that are connected to it. And every time that I recognize one more, when I name it, when I see it, when I tell my partner about it, when I put it in this giant box of things that I'm dealing with, I feel like I'm one piece closer to figuring out who I am and who the abuse made me. And then I get to sort out who I really am. So I think this, like, education piece is really powerful to start to pick apart and figure that out.
You can't learn yourself and you can't learn growth without education. I don't think education around these subjects should be seen as negative or encouraging of negative things. I think education only helps us grow in general.
Exactly. And once again, it helps you learn more about yourself. And it's a hard thing to recognize, but you know, the healing process, what it has brought me is also recognizing the ways that the impact of child sexual abuse has impacted me for the better. I like that I'm a person that's not addicted to caffeine or not easily addicted to other substances because they scare me. I like that I'm someone that is really open to talking to other people and down to talk about any kind of trauma you got. I am not a small talk kind of girl. Like, I am ready to be there for my community in really open-ended ways. I like that I am a strong person, that even when I'm triggered, I have found ways within myself to push forward and to move on and to bring that negative experience with me and make it a positive person. And I think part of the healing process is also being able to recognize the beautiful ways that it unfortunately impacted us in positive ways too, and to, like, bring that with you.
I think that is so beautiful. And I think that for people listening, that might be a hard pill to swallow, that this trauma has actually served you positively in any way. And we're not condoning violence or abuse. I think that it's important to notice that with the way that you've adapted and found ways to cope and survive, these mechanisms you've used also make you unique, beautiful, smarter sometimes, stronger sometimes. It just does. I look back on my personal history and I think of times that maybe I used to think that the way that I saw the world around me, so much negative, was a bad thing. But now I realize, like, it's helped me with safety planning. I'm a better advocate for it. I'm very aware. And so there's two sides of the coin. Yes, obviously it impacted you. But as you grow and you go from victim to survivor to then thriver, there's this point, especially around thriver, where you look back and you're like, I made it. I did all these things, and all these things that could have been negative, I made it work for me to make myself a better person.
Absolutely. And this is not a conclusion that a lot of survivors come to day one of the healing process.
No.
I'm a decade in, I'm at my master's level of healing, still working on the PhD. Like, so, you know, this is not a day one concept, but, you know, hopefully maybe one day you get there. I think the last piece around sort of what does the healing process look like for survivors that I think is really important to name is the connection to culture. That's a huge piece that a lot of mainstream, you know, sexual assault programs have left out, but that studies show, and more important than studies, survivors tell us that connection to your culture and your family and your history and legacy is really deeply powerful. And it's part of engaging in your community and truly knowing yourself and feeling that connection to your community and to your culture, to your spirituality, whatever that looks like, is a source of soothing and comfort and healing for survivors.
Absolutely. It could be a form of self-love, just really understanding your roots and how maybe culturally you've experienced what you have individually, but also your family or your background has that same form of trauma and it's intergenerational. And then you look at your family, you also see that strength and how they've been resilient and pushed forward. You look at your community and how despite adversity, they've pushed on and they're still pushing. So I think that that develops like a warrior spirit within yourself. And it tells you, I can keep going. I don't have to end at this part of my story. There's so much more to me. What are concrete ways programs can make their services more welcoming to an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse?
Well, this is what I spend my whole career doing. So I have probably more answers than we would ever have time for. But if you've been paying attention for the rest of this podcast, I think the answers will start to feel clear, which is that as advocacy programs, we can't create sort of a menu of options, a list of options for survivors that call. And because the vast majority of that list usually consists of help moving through the criminal legal system, support groups and shelter. And that's kind of what we've got. Or maybe like a referral to a therapist or to counseling. But if you've been listening to sort of what are the impacts of child sexual abuse and what does the healing process look like, almost nothing that we have touched on is fixed by shelter or even sometimes therapy. What we've said is healing is community. Help build that community in your program. Connect survivors with other survivors. A lot of programs tell me they don't have enough survivors, particularly in their rural communities, to create a specific support group for adult survivors of child sexual abuse. That's okay. Connect one adult survivor of child sexual abuse to another who says that they want community, they want support, they're interested in a support group, but maybe there's only two and that's not enough for a support group. Connect them with each other. Tell them to go out for coffee. Give them each other's phone numbers, obviously with their consent, to build that connection with each other. And then create services that are, you know, creative, expansive, collaborative, open ended, not a list that you can put on a brochure or quickly say on a phone line. The number of options that are available for advocacy are truly endless. I've been with survivors while they have navigated being pregnant for the first time, also a really triggering experience to have people want to touch your body all the time without your consent. People you love and also strangers on the street are telling you like what you can eat, what you can't eat, what you can do with your body. A lot of invasive medical appointments, anticipating pain in your genitals at the end of the birth experience, right? Those are all really triggering things. So creating services that say, you're going to come in, we're going to talk about your life, and we're going to figure out what are the places where the trauma intersects with your life and how we can help you move forward. Like I said, expansive and collaborative and open-ended. I think of this question I got actually just yesterday from an advocate who was saying that they were working with a 14-year-old survivor, child sexual abuse survivor, who wasn't ready or willing to talk about the abuse yet, and they didn't really know how to move forward. And my answer was, Of course, he's not ready to talk, right? It's if you haven't built the trust, if you haven't built the safety, of course he doesn't feel ready yet to talk about it. So it might take months for you to build a relationship that feels trusting. And in doing so, you can spend your appointments playing video games, coloring, playing basketball, going on walks. Who knows, whatever he wants to do that's interesting or fun, but just be people together, build the trust. And only after the trust is built are you ever going to be able to talk about the abuse and the ways that it has impacted his life. Unfortunately, a lot of programs, because of funding, don't put priority in building those kind of trusting relationships.
I think that that's a key piece, though. I think you're absolutely right that when you think about trust, especially for a child victim, you have to understand that that's not something that's just, hi, I'm an advocate, tell me all the things. Okay, I don't know you. You're an adult. The last person that hurt me was an adult. That's what comes to a child's mind. So building rapport, building trust is so important in all agencies that provide sexual assault services should be working on that just expansively, like you said.
I've had a lot of appointments when I worked with survivors, just coloring. We spent a lot of time coloring, sometimes coloring just in silence, just being in a room together in silence, working on things. Every once in a while being like, oh, I like that color. You know what I mean? That was the whole experience. And after weeks and weeks and weeks of that, did we get anywhere where we were talking kind of about the abuse? But it took that time. I had a coworker who worked with an adult survivor of child sexual abuse that just physically was like incapable of saying the words out loud, saying any words out loud. So their appointments looked like the survivor would bring a notebook with her and she would write big long paragraphs and then hand it to the advocate. And my coworker, the advocate, would read it and respond out loud and say, oh, wow. You know, all the things that advocates say, right? Respond. And then pass the notebook back and the survivor would write it down, right? Just being creative, thinking, how can we do this in a way that feels okay to you? There's a program in Michigan called the Firecracker Foundation that works exclusively with child sexual abuse survivors and helps them do, you know, body-based healing with yoga. And I was talking to the director, her name is Tashmika, and one of the yoga instructors had come to her and said, you know, there's this boy in one of my yoga classes that comes every week, sits on his yoga mat, doesn't participate in the yoga, and I feel like I'm failing him. I don't know what else I'm supposed to be doing to help him do the yoga, participate with everyone else. What am I doing wrong? And Tashmika's answer was so beautiful to me. She said, you're not doing anything wrong. You have a child who's been severely traumatized and is choosing to show up every week and sit on his mat. You're inviting him to do yoga and he's not doing it. He's getting to make a choice and you're respecting that choice. How is that not the most powerful thing you can do?
I love for a child that sexual story survivor? So much. I love that story so, so much. And for anyone listening that is not a victim of childhood sexual abuse and hears that story and doesn't get it because they're like, but the child's not doing the thing that'll make them feel better. Let me just break this down real quick. What's going to make them feel the best is if someone respected their choice to not do anything and didn't pressure them or hurt them or make them feel uncomfortable or weird. Just let them be. What could be more peaceful and joyful to that child than just let me be? Oh, I love that story.
So I love it. It gives me goosebumps whenever I say that story. I love it so much. The last example that I kind of think of is that there was this program, an advocate came to me in the last couple of months and said that there was a survivor that had called, an adult survivor of child sexual abuse who'd called up and sort of said, like, I'd like to access, you know, criminal legal services. I'd like to report. And the advocate came to me and said, you know, how am I supposed to help? Because here in Kansas, it's too far past the statute of limitations, that it won't go anywhere. And this is all that she's asked for. So it's all I know how to help with. And my answer to her was, there's more there that I think that through shows like, you know, Law and Order SVU or just conversations in television and movies, the idea that most survivors have in order to heal or move forward is just the criminal legal system. It's the only option anyone's ever sort of presented for them. And so I think a lot of survivors contact programs and ask for that. And if that's what people are asking for, help them navigate it, whatever that looks like. I'm not saying take away resources. I'm saying add more resources in because there's a lot more there. And the more that I talked to this advocate, you know, she shared that this survivor had eloped 20 years ago because she did not want to invite the person that harmed her to her wedding. And she knew that even if she didn't invite this person, they would just show up. And that was so painful. But now this person has passed away, and grappling with that. And I was like, there is so much to unpack that has nothing to do with the criminal legal system. And the start of the healing process can start now. And the end of the process might look like renewing your vows with your whole community and family around you and getting to have that wedding that you deserve to have all those years ago. Like, those are the kinds of really creative, expansive ideas that I think we can help survivors with that therapists and the criminal legal system can't help with. That's what's so cool about advocacy. It's what I love so much about my job, that we get to do whatever it is that's going to help the survivor. And so that looks like getting to do a million different things that we could never even start to, you know, try to list.
So my last two final questions, what do you want survivors to know?
This is a very hard question to answer, but I think that what it boils down to, my answer is, what I want survivors to know is that you don't have to just get through each day. You don't have to just bear it. That there are options available to you no matter how long ago you experienced the violence. You could be 80 years old and just now willing to open that box and peek through it. And there are ways that are going to make you feel healed and comforted and supported. You just have to be willing to open that box, which I know is so scary. But I swear at the end of the journey, you feel so much lighter than that feeling of just bearing and getting through each day.
That's an awesome answer. What motivates you to do the work you do?
I've had people in my life that saw my potential, saw what I couldn't see yet, that I could find ways to get through life and it not feel so hard and so exhausting and so traumatizing. And, you know, many of those people are still in my life today and are still helping me, and I get to help them too. It's the beautiful thing about being in this movement, that I happen to be able to surround myself with a community of people that have such a deep understanding of trauma and abuse, and we can support each other. We are our own, you know, informal support group. And it just motivates me to find other people who, like me, need someone to see them and to share some of the answers that I've found for myself, and to get to delight in them finding new and different answers for themselves.
I can honestly say, I'm not sure what people are, when they hear this, what they're going to think, but thank you. It was empowering, emotional, educational, having this conversation with you. I think for anyone that listens, they're going to feel strong and they're going to connect and they're going to reach out. Because how could you not, after hearing all these great things that you have said to help empower survivors?
I hope so.
I want to thank you for being on the podcast today, everyone. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for our next episode.
You've been listening to the Call Your Advocate podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode with me and my special guest, Leah Green, on healing from childhood sexual abuse. I hope you enjoyed learning about the process and the dynamics of what it means to heal after childhood sexual abuse, and that you reach out for help if you need it. As always, stay tuned for our next episode.